Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Namaste, my friends. This is Alec Vishal Rubin, here to welcome you to the Yoga Revealed podcast. Today, we are truly blessed to hear from a master in his trade, Richard Freeman, senior student of Patabi Joyce, Guruji. He's among the master Ashtanga teachers that bless us with his presence today. Stay tuned as we dive deep into the theory and philosophical teachings that our yoga practice reveals within.
Thank you for tuning in to Yoga Revealed Podcast. My name is Alec Rubin, and it is such an honor to sit across from master student and incredible dedicated teacher through the practice of Ashtanga Vinyasa, Richard Freeman. He keeps the thread of yoga so pure and alive here in beautiful Boulder, Colorado. Thank you, Richard, for inviting me into your home and taking space out of your day to share with us the yoga as it has been found in you. I'd like to start out with just kind of getting a little synopsis for perhaps those who are unsure of where you come from and how long you've been practicing yoga, when you first got onto the mat and how your yoga journey began to reveal to you what it is.
Long time ago, I guess. And when I first went to college in 1968, that was my chance to get a yoga mat. Well, actually, they didn't have yoga mats. They were yoga blankets made of cotton. And I'm sitting on one right now. In fact, this is a nice old one. And sticky mats weren't around until, I think, the mid-70s or something. And so I was in college, and because it was the 60s, I was a very inspired student in terms of, becoming awakened and enlightened. And so I started my practice from books. I actually, in 68, taught a small yoga class at my college, though I didn't know what I was doing. I'm not sure I know yet what I'm doing. But I was very inspired. And we just used the various materials that were available. There were a few books on yoga that were out. There was, of course, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was a very big book in the late 60s. There was an edition called The Psychedelic Experience by Timothy Leary, the man who later became Ram Dass. I found a teacher in early 1969, over the winter of 68 to 69, who was a Zen Roshi in Chicago, at the Chicago Zen Temple. And they only taught one yoga posture there at the Zen Do. It was but they taught it very well. And so my experience from the very beginning has been eclectic, in the sense that I was very inspired by, say, the Bhagavad Gita, by the what we knew of, you know, various bhakti scriptures, and also tantric scriptures, hatha yoga scriptures, from both the what we call Hindu, which is actually a very broad, inaccurate category, and then the Buddhist schools of practice. And so I've had, I guess, the good fortune, at least in my opinion, of confusing the two together and bridging, you know, any theoretical differences between them. And I find that being slightly eclectic in my practice actually makes me look deeper, because I can't really surrender to a single formula, but I like to look deeply into each formula and then practice and look at, you know, this is experience, an experience that's indescribable is being described and formulated. And so, but I found that it's very easy for myself and then others too to get the description confused with what they're trying to describe, which is kind of too wonderful for words. And so I was an eclectic from the beginning. And yet I'm fairly, you know, I can kind of pretend to be orthodox at the same time. And I think that, you know, that's the paradox. You know, you can really stick with, say, one teacher or one thing, and you eventually, if it's working, you know, you can see all the others in it. And of course, we know that one school of practice or one religion, they claim to include all the others, but they don't really. It's something that is more, you know, that which is more profound in them is what includes all the others. So
the school that inspired you to focus more upon was Ashtanga Vinyasa.
Eventually, oh yeah. It took a while. And it was not until, let's see, 19 years later that I met Batavi Joyce. Having heard about him, and we clicked. And, you know, his methodology, the Ashtanga Vinyasa, is rather rigorous. Fortunately, at the time, you know, I'd studied a lot of postures in yoga, and I could do it. And so we really connected not on the level of the postures, but he was, you know, in a way, very interesting mystic and practitioner. And so we connect on a level of philosophy and more internal practice.
Did you ever get to study with his teacher?
Krishnamacharya? No. I studied briefly with Deshikachar and more extensively with Iyengar and Iji Mohan. And I've met a lot of, you know, Krishnamacharya students. But I never met him.
So
he must be quite a guy.
So with such an array of styles of yoga around today, especially in 2016, there must be, I wish that you could speak to, a common aim that all of these styles we can meet in. Mm-hmm. What would be the aim of yoga? I could ask you, what is yoga?
Yeah.
But what is the aim of yoga?
Yeah, you've got to choose some words here. The aim of yoga is to kind of wake up to what's happening, what's really happening. Otherwise, we're unhappy and we don't really see how not only do we connect, you know, are we as two people, are we as a, you know, living beings connecting with all the other beings around us on this little planet. But although we live in, if we don't connect that way, which is the yoga, then we live in our heads, basically. And we have a kind of theoretical existence where we have a theoretical self that our mind, which makes up good stories, makes up, you know, like the story of Richard, which is, I don't know whether it's a comedy or a tragedy or totally boring or what. But, you know, and there are many stories within that story, but none of those stories is actually me, and none of the stories. And all those things are partial theories, and the same in our, and what yoga is that something goes on deep inside that wakes you up into the and everybody kind of knows something about it. Everyone's had a little taste of that. But it wakes you up to the absolutely astonishing, wonderful nature of things. And it wakes you up in such a way that you don't really, that you're satisfying. You know, even if you're not advanced at yoga, even if you don't meet your checklist of what waking up means, you know, like my, the top of my head doesn't glow like the sunshine. You know, maybe I better work on it another 10,000 lifetimes, or, you know, I still have thoughts. And, but it, what it does, it, yoga is this way of almost enjoying little things, you know, almost like a connoisseur would, even, and that at the same time being utterly, you know, seeing yourself in other beings, other people, and of course then other, sometimes it's easier with animals to see yourself than other people. And that's quite nice. And then again, you know, then yoga gives you a sense of humor in that you sort of think, well, if, when you see yourself in other people, the mind always gives you a total opportunity to misinterpret that. The ego comes in and takes over and says, well, yeah, all beings are really Richard Freeman. Okay, rather than seeing that. That's not what we're talking about. And so what yoga is, it wakes you up. In other words, you're just waking up out of this kind of semi-dream states. And the process of waking up is extremely joyous. No matter what's... And there are many systems of yoga, and some would, you know, give you 10,000 stages of waking up. And others would say, oh, that's all similar, it's all the same. Up and, you know, and you're happy, you know, even if you find out from your teacher that you're a raw beginner, it's like, yes, yeah, love it.
Yes.
10 million more lifetimes. Yes.
Yes. I think that moves into another great question that had come to me. I was feeling, what does happiness look like in the yoga practice? Or perhaps, what is contentment look like in a yoga practice?
Right, what does it look like? You know, what? How does the smile look on the face? there's a, well, in the yoga practice, I think one of the best ways to talk about it is how the prana moves in the body. And so prana is basically, it's usually translated as life force or internal breath. And it's really all the sensations that you have are prana. And so it's what you're really experiencing right, you know, in front of your awareness, you know, at the front is sensations. If you kind of slow down all the theory making, there's just sensations, which are prana. And prana is really just a vibration. Mm-hmm. And when it's not, when it's just, you allow it, just observe it without needing to change it due to some theory about what it is. Now you see that the nature of that vibration is contentment, is joy, or is, you know, sorry, to say anything is, runs the danger of you then having a concept about it. But just letting that vibration unfold is giving it space. And this has an effect throughout the body, where the body becomes almost invisible or luminous or nice, nectar. Mm-hmm. Yet, you're still able to do things if the occasion should arise, the necessity should arise. Like answering your emails. I don't know, and what's that look like? I don't know. It's... But there's, when there's this kind of new vision of things that the yoga gives you. It's kind of a vision that things are all interconnected. That there's not really a separate thing out there. You know, it's almost like the whole thing is, and I can't say you, or the whole thing is emptiness, or the whole thing is God, or because what do I mean by those words? Or the whole thing is prana vibrating, revealing pure awareness, pure chit. Yeah. What do you mean by that? Just practice and find out.
Yeah. Segueing into your personal practice and how it has evolved from college to meeting Patavi, Guruji, to being into the daily life where you've embraced injuries in the past and you've healed. How do we sustain a yoga practice over the course of our life?
This is where it helps to have a teacher or a lineage of teachers or a number of teachers that allow you to look at your experience deeply. Because life is full of, you know, change, and obviously the body changes. And so in yoga practice, particularly when we're thinking, most people think of hatha yoga practice, you know, where you're standing on your head, and bhastrika, bellows breathing, and, you know, trying, you know, making good effort. And so there naturally develops an attachment to feeling strong and feeling good in the body, which is totally natural. And then what eventually happens is there's some injury, you know, whether you deserve it or not, you know, that's a totally irrelevant thing, but it happens. Or sickness, and then old age, which creeps up on you, but it always arrives, you know, a little bit sooner than you thought it was going to. And then it seems that death comes, you know, that's what, if you look around, you know, where are all the really old yogis? Well, they're gone. What's up with that? And so one of the beautiful things I think about lineages and then communities or sangha, you know, where you know other practitioners, or if you're really fortunate, you're locally, you know a number of practitioners and you practice with them on occasion, just to see that you're all in the same boat, same situation, you let go of your identification with the body. Because if you identify with the body, then there's trouble coming called disease, old age, and death. But instead, the kind of the community, the sense of camaraderie with other people who, it turns out, if you communicate with them, really have exactly the same situation as you. You know, they might have a unique injury in their body, you know, like it could be my hip joint and your neck, or, you know, but the same process is beginning. And you learn to actually see with clarity and to let go. And even if the body is decrepit, and even in my case, if you can't do the same postures you did 20, 30, 40 years ago, and eventually we're all going to have to let go of all of our yoga postures. So I've read. The very process of letting go is wonderful. You know, it's just like, it's just, you know, say you collect together the entire world through vinyasa. It's almost like you're picking up pieces of your psyche and you're balancing, you know, the prana, this part of your body, and getting all of your affairs in order. And then finally you do what's called nyasa or sannyasa, is you just put it down and let go. And in that letting go, it's like, this, it's like sunshine, freedom. And so we're all doing that. And the nice thing about time is, one, the terrible thing is, it's kind of the nice, the terrible thing is you start to see the misery that misperception causes. And that most of the beings that we associate with, you know, different phases of terrible misery, and then you too and me too, and then the yoga actually teaches you how to, with a sense of compassion for others and yourself, let go. And in the process of letting go, you wake up and you then develop, you know, this really nice taste for the little things in life. You know, just sensation itself is like, wow. You know? And you're much easier to please than when you were younger. When you were young, you needed things. You know, I need the entire universe to understand. Yeah. And then, you know, as we get older, we're, you know, it's like, wow, I'm getting to inhale again. This is fantastic.
You know, this thought brings up a yoga sutra to me that I'd love for you to tap into. I've been reading it in the book How Yoga Works. I forget by who it's by, Jacine, I believe. And it's Yoga Sutra 2.5. Avidya consists of a transient object that seems to be everlasting. Confusing misery is happiness. Confusing an impure object is pure. Confusing the non-self
as having self. As being self.
Itself. So it's, you know, things that cannot seem to last seem to us as if they will in that way.
Yeah.
And so how is it that, you know, we can continue to approach such philosophical ideas within yoga and embrace them with the Yoga Sutras? How can we take the Yoga Sutras into our lives more than just reading them? Because personally, I read some of the sutras and they come in one ear and they just
right out
the other.
Yeah.
And I've had to like unpack a sutra for weeks in order to even like try to grasp.
Yep.
Exactly. It just takes time.
It just takes time. The Yoga Sutra is... So the traditional way of studying something like the Yoga Sutra is to memorize it. And since it's not in rhythmical verse, it's more difficult to memorize than many of the other scriptures. Because usually they're written in verse, and so at least there's rhythm, so you can kind of walk down the street and you can kind of, you know, do it with a drum beat, you know, and remember. But so you learn it, and then you almost treat it like mantra. You're just going, turning it over and over and over again. And a lot of the, and then there's some verses that click with you. And those are, that's good. You gotta get a foothold or a toehold in the whole thing. And you go into the ones that click with you, and you just keep investigating that. And then you just take occasionally some new verse, and then you try to understand it. And, it's not easy. But that particular thing, you know, ignorance is called avidya in the Yoga Sutra. Not knowing the nature of reality is the cause of suffering. And if you knew the nature of reality, then you go, wow, it's fantastic. It's like, it's almost funny, it's fantastic. It's like a very beautiful joke in a way. Not a joke in that, you know, suffering is deep and real, but it's so wonderful that it's insubstantial, and that there's nobody getting hurt in these, you know, even in ourselves. You know, it's like, well, I'm getting hurt by the misery of my body or the insanity of my mind, but keep look. And it's just the misperception that you're in there, that somebody's in there that is a separate little person, little
entity.
Yeah, but there's actually not a separate person there. It's just us, pure awareness. And then
that Purusha?
Purusha, which is pure awareness. And so it's easy to think of, you know, what is Purusha? You then define it as a separate self, which is the whole teaching, is that there is no separate self. So that's a paradox. And so a lot of these philosophers are kind of like, you know, they're semi-comedians, in, you know, in a very compassionate, they're compassionate comedians, and they have no choice because, you know, this basic ignorance. And it's not like you go to university and memorize and study yoga philosophy, although that could be an excellent way to study, but just to study it as a subject won't take you into the heart of it, which is, I couldn't say it's you, but it's the not you that we're taking it into. And so many of the valid traditions, this is what's at their heart. And of course, they're expressed in different ways by different cultures and different peoples, different times. But that has to be that, because, you know, and as each of us start to understand it, we go, and we kind of develop our own semi-private language about it, like we do with, you know, things in our life that are both, like we do with, you know, things in our life that are both, you know, they have a special name, you know, they have a special name, you know, and then as we communicate with others, we start to see, oh yeah, same things going on, the same process is going on.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking the other day, what is karma? And how is karma tied into our practice? By practicing or by not practicing?
Yeah, either could be karma. Like the Gita says, inaction can also be karma. Because if you have inaction due to fear or repulsion, doubt, you know, all these things, that'll have consequences. And it might be the right thing to do at a certain time, like picking at a scab and the doctor stop doing that. And you stop, okay, that's the inaction made the little wound heal. But then other times, inaction is a terrible thing to have, you know. And so that's play by play, circumstance by circumstance. But an interesting thing is that kare, to do, is considered to be a sacred thing. It's a vibration. You know, it's a dialectic, and it's a vibration or changes within these structures that manifest in the world. And the more that there's intelligence, then the more skillful is the action. And skillful action ultimately reveals, just like vibration of prana reveals pure consciousness. So skillful action is like just another level of that vibration, that dialectic of prana, or our intelligence is what we do in the world, or don't do in the world, but it's vibration, back and forth. Because you do something, you get feedback from your environment, and then you correct, you know, you tune it, fine tune it. And then occasionally it comes where you just gotta like try something. And you try it, you know, you have an intention, you know, formulated. Even though you know it's beyond formulation, you still gotta formulate it, because that's what the mind does. So you make an intention and you think, well, the best way seems to be this. And you never know for sure. There's always this huge cloud of unknowing that surrounds us, mm-hmm. and even our, you know, I'm sure that this is going to work for you. If you go gluten-free, I'm sure you'll become happy in 2 days, and you don't know. And so one, the yoga lets you rest in not knowing. That's nirodha, you know, from the yoga. And you don't know, but you're somehow like, you just know that it's, you know, in a sense of direct experience, that it's nectar, it's life. But you don't know with any kind of absolute certainty. You have relative certainty, you know, that which we, you know, we have science for. But still, you experiment, you get feedback, and you make large or small corrections. Even in the practice of yoga, you know, although we receive the teachings and lineages, you have to figure out what the technique is really for, and then how to work with it in the unique circumstances that you have. So it takes that kind of, they call it shraddha, or trust, faith. Shraddha. And it's always like the first step.
So with all the nectar, perhaps, I don't know if the opposite is, Halahala.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's an interesting word. Halahala. It, one is a poisonous herb. Okay, to be avoided. Cooking or collecting spices. It's it was the result of, the initial result of practice is that you, this toxin comes up in that you start to feel almost the insanity of your mind from when you first started to practice. And this is actually a good sign, if you have the faith, just to hold it, not accept it or reject it, but to hold it. And so that's one of the keys, you know, that makes it a real yoga practice, is that the practice brings up a kind of anxiety, a kind of fear, a kind of intuition about how profound impermanence is, you know, like, what does that mean in my life, impermanence? Well, it means one, you and everybody and everything is like, what's its value?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to exist in 10 billion years, mm-hmm. or 200 billion, whatever. And you feel that, you go, oh shit. And that's good. And then, if it's actually the beginning of yoga, then that is like there's this little bit of compassion that lets you just be there not knowing what to do. You know, is there anybody even to do it? But still feeling the halahala. This is so in the myth, so about Hala Hala that churned the ocean to make nectar, but they got the opposite. Shiva comes, and he goes down to the, and he scoops up all the Hala Hala, and he slurps it into his mouth and holds it without swallowing it. So his throat turned blue. And this is like a profound teaching in that myth. And it's really what the practice of meditation is. Mm-hmm. Practice of yoga, nirodha, is really holding Hala Hala, or whatever it is, in the space of your awareness, like a compassionate, just like you, you know, if your kid were sick, you just hold them. You know? And so you hold your own fear, your own anger, and you hold other people's fear and anger in the space of your own awareness, your own compassion. And another meaning of the word Hala Hala, I'm thinking about this, and it's the holiday season. Oh, I think the English word holiday might relate to the word Hala Hala. But that's another thing. That's funny. But it also means a whirligig, like, you know, the wheel of samsara, or like a Ferris wheel or merry-go-round, is a halal. And I think it sounds like the English word hell. It's a halal.
Yeah.
And that's where you grab on and you're just like taken on a ride.
Going on it.
But it's a ride of circles where everything loops. The mind is going in these loops of being stuck, you know, stuck with desire, stuck with the impossibility of getting rid of the torture of being unable to live up to an ideal that no one can live up to. It's just the torture of being a human being.
Mm.
And that's the difficulty in any of the good lineages of yoga. You're going to come to that stage, and a lot of lineages will be very gentle about it, but there you are, where others will just throw you in. And at that point, you know, where the lineages then start to connect to each other, because they're really, you know, just variations on a theme.
You know, I feel that I've spent most of my own life tormented by myself in anxiety. And only recently, over the last 2-3 years, have I watched those thoughts stop or still slow down. And I think that's just from my own practice and showing up.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what tips could you, or state of being could you offer our listeners who feel anxious in the day-to-day, or just like having to go, you know? I think that's a big, perhaps, delusion that comes with the Western world.
Oh yeah, it comes with technology. Yeah, one is that practice, and a lot of practices you can take into the field with you. Sometimes I know in the Ashtanga yoga world, people think, well, I have to practice 2 hours. I have to do the entire series, or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, 6 series all at once. And if you have the luxury of time and good health, and perhaps youth or something, yeah, go ahead, you know, that's wonderful. But then again, you know, occasionally circumstances will catch up with you where you can't. But if you can just do 5 minutes, or you can do your mantra in the taxi, on the bus, or, you know, in your jail cell, or whatever, in the ambulance. Those are also practices. And so a lot of the practices can give you a nice sense of connectedness and at least some calm, even though you're in the middle of a storm. And find those little things. And it could be just a, not even a mantra, you know, it could be just a verse from the Yoga Sutra or a great poet or a simple breathing. You know, pranayama is, you know, all those breathing things in which you unravel the prana from being stuck in different ways. And they're very simple pranayamas that don't require that you be, that you're in a monastery or that you're physically fit, but they're simple ways of just delighting in the fact of your breath, even if it's a little bit choppy or asymmetrical. It's still kind of nice compared to the alternative. And so yoga really, you know, in a way, it takes you back to appreciating just little things. Nice. Rather than, even though you start to, you know, I see the big picture finally, but
yeah.
We've heard that before.
What is the dharma of the yogi?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends. You can put it in very general terms. Because the dharma of the yogi is to wake up and then to be yoga. You know, and then you could extend that, well, the dharma of the yogi, if they're waking up, is they're going to all of a sudden see other beings. And they're going to all of a sudden find that if other beings are unhappy, there'll always be that fact to make them want to do something to help other beings. So the dharma of other yogis is going to be like the bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism, is to help others, which is, you know, delightful, even though, and then you find, well, there's no end of
helping,
because there's no end to how you can help other beings. And in a general sense, that's our dharma. And then there's dharma in the sense of your individual dharma, which means you got to do what you got to do. And so, like the Gita saying, you know, you have to do your own dharma, you're doing it imperfectly. And so from any kind of view where you're sitting down and figuring it out, it's always going to be imperfect. Your fulfillment of what you think is your life's work, or your, you know, say my dharma is to write poetry, you know, okay, well, it can't be good enough, you know. And then, so it's better to do yours imperfectly than somebody else's perfectly, because somebody else's you see from an external point of view, so it's in a formula in your mind. So I'll do 108 sun salutations every day, and I'll chant some, the Quran every morning. And you can do that, but if at the same time you're neglecting your friend, you know, you're neglecting your sick parents or something, because you can't bear the thought of them, then you're not getting, you're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. You're avoiding your own dharma, which is to respond to the circumstances around you compassionately and intelligently. And then that word also is funny, because the end of the Gita, Krishna says, you all dharma parityaja, all around you just let it, you release it, and then you just come to me. In other words, so the love, which is other beings, you let go of all this formulated duties and obligations, and you just come to me. And the place to find me in that sense is in other beings. So back to the bodhisattva as dharma.
Segueing topics, how do you feel about the commercialization of yoga? And what do you feel about the future
of yoga?
Yeah,
well, I'm hopeful. So commercialization is kind of, it's been made into a commodity by some people who see that there's money in it. And indeed, you know, it's a nice thing. And if, and so I see one, the positive side is if we can get more and more people to try it, the better. Because a certain percentage, even 10% of the people who try yoga will go, wow, and they'll get a sense of what it's really about. Then the question is if you make it so that a lot of people want to do it, is it yoga anymore? And that's all, that's an open question.
Wouldn't the duty be on the teacher?
Yeah, the duty. But then you've got to communicate to that teacher. You know, it's got to come down the line.
Who's the teacher's teacher?
Yeah, who's the teacher's teacher, you know. So when I was first in India, back in the, you know, the very early 70s, I was, people would always say, who's your guru? And, you know, and then, you know, then they were like, oh, okay, you can come in, you know, or you can do this or that, you know. Are you in this for real? Or are you just some kind of a tourist or something? And, but then again, you know, the tradition, if you look at the history of yoga, it's always, you know, they're very creative people who are always, you know, bringing in stuff. And so it's a living tradition, and it has to adapt to the modern world and to modern knowledge of body, the mind, and then how to practice, you know, because we don't live in, you know, a nice rural village, you know, the Himalayas or something, which would be nice. And so it's always an open question, like, is this, and so whenever I see something or a magazine, I always go, oh my God. And I say, oh, that article's pretty good. You know, well, that one's like, ah. And so I think we should all keep working for now to make sure that it comes out okay.
Yeah. Nice. So say a student has plateaued, or they feel that they've plateaued in their practice. What are three tips, effective tips, that you can offer that would allow students to continue to make way into the, you know, infinite growth that is this practice?
One, the plateau is natural, I think, in these kinds of systems that the mind creates. Because sometimes in what you think is a plateau, you know, you're just looking at it from, say, in my strength and flexibility. Like, I plateaued a long time ago. And, but what's happening if, you know, if you continue to study, so one, studying. Even though some people are very adverse to, you know, that type of thing, if you, and for some of us, you know, we study books, we study philosophy, we study the traditional teachings. Or you study any subject that you really find interesting. You know, which could be the anthropology of yoga, the sociology of yoga, the history of yoga. You know, as a skeptic, you can, but all of those things are just unfold into their background. It's just like fascinating. We study, you know, astronomy or biology or medicine. Study keeps you, because you're putting in information into the system, and a lot of the processing is unconscious during a period of plateau. And I think for a lot of, you know, sincere yoga people, there's a lot of processing going on that's unconscious. And then all of a sudden, you know, the whatever those processes are, those samskaras spinning, with, when you're not even thinking about it, oh, it pops up with a new idea. it's important for practitioners to know that a lot of the, sometimes, like a philosophical problem, you think about it and it says, oh, that's paradox, driving me crazy. You just put it on the shelf and take a walk. Or, you know, your equivalent of walking. And then the mind comes up later with, oh, there's an insight into it. Because, you know, we work on it in the back of our minds. So to keep studying, keep interacting. Because we're learning, even from our frustrations. You know, sometimes I'm frustrated with the traffic on my way to the yoga studio. And so we're dealing with our own attachments and anxieties, you know, about, or little health problems, which seems like a lot of people have little health problems, little imperfections. Everybody does. And so I was like, And it's also a good practice to practice with other people now and then. It depends on your personality type. But to come across, you know, a different group of practitioners or something can really wake you up and kind of re-inspire you. And so, not that you should go to a different yoga studio, although maybe you should check them out.
Yeah.
There's a stage in when one becomes a monk in India. There's a, you know, you're then a sannyasin, and you're, technically, you know, your job is to study and to practice, and then to teach. And one of the first duties is they send you off, and you have to go around and you have to visit all these, as many teachers and ashrams as you can find. You know, some of them really bad places run by psychopaths. Others, you know, you find some little baba off under a tree, absolutely delightful. But you just keep going and you see, oh, that manifestation. And then you start to get a sense of camaraderie with all these other lineages of practice, which is important because politics is a huge obstacle. And particularly, I think historically, it's always been a big obstacle. Those Buddhists on the hill, they're all crazy, you know, don't go there. And one day you get up your courage and you go there and save them. They're just delightful. And so new experiences can be good.
Nice. Love that. As we continue to practice and we peel back the layers, getting down to our universal truth, what would be something that you would like to remind the world of? Something that perhaps has surprised you through your years of practice?
We're all so similar. And even those amongst us who that, you know, are, we don't like, not that you should go out and try to save crazy, you know, psychopathic people or certain extremists and things. But if somehow they can communicate, if you can communicate, they can communicate, then those, which means to actually interface with the environment, that has a huge, powerful effect. Politically and spiritually on people. And it's really these ego blocks that turn us into extremists, where then we do things that hurt, you know, hurt ourselves and others. And I think, you know, and of course yoga can be turned into, you know, crazy stuff. You know, you become an extremist. But I think if you look at the variety of good traditions within yoga. It's exactly what is being broken down, is this inability to interface and to communicate. So that's my...
And that's a great nugget. Connection, communication. Cool. And I know you are writing a book with Ms. Mary.
Yes.
Yeah. When is your book being released?
Next November, which will be November 2016.
Is there a title?
The Art of Vinyasa.
Oh, we'll look out for that.
Please.
Yeah. What's it like to have raised a son and be a father with the years that you have held and being who you are and traveled as you have? What's it like to be a father in your life?
Oh, well, it's one, challenging, but it awakens in me compassion, love, and moments of excitement. Because there are moments where we actually flash and we get it, you know, like, and that's, I think, true for any parent, you know, it's the ultimate torture, but it's totally amazing.
Nice.
Maybe you'll see.
I hope so. One day. Not soon, but one day.
Yeah.
One day. Well, to end, we like to receive one more nugget that you would offer to the listeners, to the practitioners, to the teachers, to the students of yoga. What is a little nugget that you'd like to offer?
Well, something that Patabi Joyce turned me on to, in the literal sense. He called it the Tadu Chakra, or the palate, which we initially experience as the roof of the mouth, and then eventually as, you know, the roof of the mouth, the soft palate, and the nasal septum. And all of that is has a huge connection to your prana. And one way to feel the palate is to soften your eyes with a steady gaze. And then just to gaze without looking at anything. And it makes this very funny smile. And perhaps that smile will reawaken your sense of humor, which will make you a better teacher.
Nice.
Anyway, that's all I have to say.
Well, Richard, thank you.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you so much for revealing what yoga has shared with you in your life and how you're keeping the thread so alive with those that you come in touch with. Thank you.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Richard is teaching yoga all over the world. You can catch him if you can by checking out his website at yogaworkshop.com. If you are ever in Boulder, Colorado, stop by the Yoga Workshop on Pearl Street and dive into the thread of Ashtanga Yoga. We hope the Yoga Revealed podcast inspires you to take new leaps into the infinite growth that is studying and living yoga. My name is Alec Rubin, and sharing our love for life with you is a dream come true. It means so much to us if you would subscribe to Yoga Revealed on iTunes and rate us with a generous 5 stars. Check us out on Instagram and YouTube for behind-the-scenes footage of the Yoga Revealed podcast team. Thanks for tuning in. Keep practicing, and may we continue to awaken together to change the world through our yoga. Namaste.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.